So I want to make the argument that spatial curvature is extremely important, and that it's something we should try very hard to detect or constrain. And most of what I'm going to say is in the context of the landscape, so I'll tell you what I mean by that. But in fact, as I'll mention, I don't think the argument that we should go after curvature really relies on the existence of the landscape at all. I think it's more general than that. But still, the point of view I'll be taking is on this slide. So string theory seems to be telling us that there are a large number of metastable phases in nature, meaning configurations of the fundamental fields, which are metastable, so small oscillations don't destroy this phase. And the vacuum energy of those different phases varies over some huge range. And so in particular, many of these phases have very large positive vacuum energy. And I should say, it's not just string theory that predicts this. Metastable phases are a very generic feature in many, many examples. They're something that happens all the time in nature at various scales. So it wouldn't be at all surprising, even if string theory isn't the right description, if there would be some number, maybe not so large, but some number of metastable phases with positive vacuum energy. Furthermore, we have evidence now. We know that there's dark energy today. The expansion of the universe is accelerating. Probably that's vacuum energy. So we have evidence that we are currently in a phase just like this. And we have evidence for inflation, which is now that much stronger, post-Bicep. So there was a period in the past when the universe expanded exponentially. So I think we have very good reason to take these ideas seriously, that it seems that exponential expansion is something that really happens. And if that's the case, and there are other phases with large vacuum energy, those, you might think, are the typical state of the universe. Those inflate very rapidly. They reproduce themselves at an extremely fast rate. So that, perhaps, is the typical state of nature. And where we live and what we see around us is something extremely atypical. It has very small vacuum energy. It's not expanding very rapidly. So why would we live in such an atypical region? The argument that's usually given is anthropic, and I'll come back to that in one moment. Here's a cartoon of this kind of a universe. So we live inside some sort of region, probably a spherical bubble. We have a Hubble length today, which limits what we can see, and we know from constraints on curvature that that length is at most about a tenth of the size of the bubble. Then outside of our bubble is some other region. There's a pointer here, right? There's some other phase out here that's expanding very rapidly, and presumably there are other bubbles living out further out in that phase. Now, even though we're limited by this horizon, we're limited in what we can see directly by this horizon, we can nevertheless infer, if we're lucky, whether or not this is the correct picture. So why would we live in such an atypical region? So why do we live in this region with very small vacuum energy? This argument goes back really to Weinberg. So Weinberg noticed that if vacuum energy is positive in our universe, then that inhibits the formation of structure, simply because it makes the universe accelerate, and so structures can be blown apart that would otherwise collapse. If you fix delta rho over rho to the measured value, lambda cannot be that much larger than what we know today it actually is. Otherwise, their structure would be exponentially rare in that universe. Now, of course, for this argument to make sense, for this argument to be an argument why lambda is small, it's necessary that many different values of lambda of the vacuum energy be possible. If only one value is possible, this doesn't tell you anything. So you need some sort of landscape in order to apply this argument. But it's worth saying that he made this prediction, and it was confirmed, although not very precisely. His prediction was something like 2 orders of magnitude too big. Now, in a bubble that forms from a phase transition, so if indeed we live in a region which exited some rapidly inflating parent phase by a first-order phase transition, bubbles that form that way have negative spatial curvature inside them. They contain homogeneous and isotropic Friedmundson-Robertson-Walker cosmologies, but those cosmologies are open. They have negative spatial curvature. If you're in a flat universe, if you have zero curvature, any overdensity will collapse, because any overdensity behaves locally like a little closed universe, and therefore it will collapse after some amount of time. But in an open universe, you have to overcome the tendency of matter to be expanding more rapidly than escape velocity. Flat is expanding at escape velocity, open is expanding faster than escape velocity. And so there's a constraint on 1 minus omega total, this is at decoupling, which says that 1 minus omega total at decoupling should be less than delta rho over rho. Okay, so this number is something like 10 to the minus 5. Omega k, this is omega k, at decoupling is about a factor of 1,000 smaller than it is today. So if omega k today is 0.01, then this constraint would just be satisfied. As I mentioned, when you tunnel from a false vacuum into some, or from a metastable state with positive vacuum energy into some other state, you end up with negative curvature. So even if you tunnel into a state which has small vacuum energy, so it's consistent with Weinberg's bound, you still have a problem because you'll have negative spatial curvature after the tunneling. So what do you do about that? Well, you have to get rid of it somehow. If the universe is initially curvature-dominated, it's forever curvature-dominated because curvature redshifts more slowly than matter or radiation. And when this bubble first appears, it's curvature-dominated. The only way to get rid of that is exponential expansion, or at least accelerated expansion. You need enough accelerated expansion to reduce the curvature down to an acceptable level. So if this happens through inflation, that inflation takes place after the tunneling inside the bubble, and there needs to be enough of it in order to allow structure to form. Back in 2005, we were thinking about this situation, and we calculated, this is with Lenny Susskind, Ben Freivogel, and Maria Rodriguez-Martinez, how many e-folds of slow roll inflation would be necessary to solve this problem. So if you live in a bubble that formed from a first order phase transition and you want structure to form, how many e-folds do you need? The answer is a bit dependent on various parameters, which we don't know very well and knew less well at the time. But generically, it's something of order 60. In other words, you need enough inflation to solve the flatness problem to allow structure to form. And so if you like, you can say that you can solve the flatness problem anthropically in this scenario. Now, if extra inflation is hard to get, so if it's hard to get a lot of e-folds of inflation, then you're likely to be close to 60 e-folds. You need 60 to form any structure, so that's a minimum. But having extra e-folds of inflation doesn't do you any good. And so if it's difficult to get log inflation, then by a version of Weinberg's argument, which again said that the lambda should be close to the limit, because there's no reason for it to be larger, no reason for it to be smaller, sorry, you would expect the number of e-folds of inflation to be not much bigger than 60. Okay, so this is an argument for why we might expect short inflation, just enough inflation to solve the flatness problem. And we pointed out a number of consequences of this reasoning. So the main prediction that we made is that the spatial curvature is negative, and we tried to estimate the chance that it would be large enough to be detectable. So if the number of e-folds is just enough to accommodate the observational limit today, then we're about to discover curvature. It's around the corner. But if it was just a few e-folds more, that exponentially reduces omega k. And so it doesn't take very much extra inflation to reduce omega k down to about 10 to the minus 5 or smaller. And in that regime, we're never going to know if the universe is curved or not, because cosmic variance for omega k is of order 10 to the minus 5. So in different horizon volumes, omega k will fluctuate, and it fluctuates by an amount of order 10 to the minus 5. So if omega k on average in the global sense is less than that number, we're not going to be able to detect it. So the question, one thing we tried to estimate is how likely is it that omega k is between, let's say, 10 to the minus 4 or a few times 10 to the minus 5 and the observational bound, 10 to the minus 2. So that's one big question. Another prediction that we made, though, was that you may generically expect that the power and scalar fluctuations would be suppressed at large angular scales in a universe like this. And the reason is essentially just that the potential close to the point where you tunnel gets steep, and that tends to reduce the amount of scalar power. It doesn't affect the tensor power. In some cases, it can actually enhance it, but it does reduce the amount of scalar power. And now, at the time we wrote this paper, there was no evidence. Actually, I think that statement is false. There was some evidence for suppression, but we didn't know about it. That part of it is certainly true. I don't know. I think we said, well, we should expect omega k, we should expect curvature, which hopefully we can measure, and we should expect a bit less power at large scales. Now, as we've heard several times today, there is some evidence for that now. And how significant that is obviously being debated. But the fact remains that WMAP observed several anomalies at large scales, one of which was a lack of power. And Planck supported that, and in fact made it more significant, not because it constrained the data at large angular scales better, but because it constrained it at high angular scales better. That allows you, that gives you more information about, for instance, the scalar tilt. And when you extrapolate down to low L, this anomaly becomes a little bit worse. And in fact, again, as we've heard, formally the Planck data prefers negative R, because negative R, if you could have it, would reduce the power at large angular scales. Now with BICEP, if R is in fact 0.1 or 0.2, these anomalies get substantially more significant, as Kendrick told us. And I think one other point, so just to connect this to BICEP, another connection is that large R means very large field range. It means super Planckian field range. And that makes this whole scenario a little bit more plausible. If you're tunneling from a very high energy vacuum and you need to inflate with small field range, you're likely to just shoot straight across and not inflate at all. It's a lot easier to inflate in a scenario where the field range is large after tunneling. So that depends on how difficult it is to get long inflation, right? So the thing that's the most uncertain, and I'll come back to it in a minute. The question was whether that argues against the idea that inflation was just enough to solve the flatness problem, just exactly 60 volts. So that is certainly the most the biggest uncertainty. We don't know how to compute the probability distribution on the number of e-folds in any reliable way. I'll come back to it in a minute and say something about it. But first, so here's this picture that I think hasn't been displayed yet at this meeting. But anyway, this shows that the Planck data prefers negative R. I mean, you can just look at it by eye, and you see that these ellipses are still opening when they hit R equals 0. So the data would sort of like to be down here. But Kendrick did a much more thorough job of explaining that. So why would the power be suppressed after tunneling? Let me come back to that. And again, the simple reason is just that if you're tunneling from some very high energy vacuum, then you have to roll down or get down somehow from that high energy to the plateau where you inflate. This is presumably string scale or some very high scale, this barrier here. So the potential must be very steep where you tunnel, and then it has to be not very steep, it has to be rather flat down here. So it goes from being very steep to being not so steep, and generally that suppresses scalar power. Exactly what it does depends a lot on the details of the model, but I think the general expectation is pretty simple. V prime is bigger, and so scalar power gets suppressed at the scales that correspond to this early part of the plateau. And this was studied again recently by these people. So coming back to Eva, to your question, what is the measure on the number of e-folds? So given that we had, let's say, at least 60, how likely is it that there weren't too many more to erase this these signals, both the suppression of scalar power and the curvature? We had a very simple-minded model. It was just, if I remember correctly, a linear potential with some parameters. That we assumed had a uniform distribution, nothing particularly well motivated, that gave something like 1 over n to the fourth. People looking at slightly better motivated models in string theory have come up with powers that are similar to this, but those are small field models, that's right. So the large field models that we know of don't predict such a sharp suppression in n. But I think one of the major uncertainties in this is there's the measure on the number of e-folds in the abstract sense that you have some space of potentials with parameters, and you assume you know the measure on the parameters, and then you can infer a measure on n. There's also a measure on n when you input the fact that we live in this landscape and we tunneled from some false vacuum. And that part of it, we really don't understand very well. So I think all we can really say is that any estimate of this P of n is very unreliable. Nevertheless, if we are observing steepening of the potential, so if we are observing something real, that scalar power is suppressed at large scales, that necessarily improves the chance that detectable curvature will exist, because it means that we're closer to that end, for whatever reason. So this is one of the reasons why trying to measure curvature, we have a better chance of success now. We have a better chance of seeing it than we did prior to BICEP. Of course, it could be, and it's quite possible, that one could see steepening without seeing curvature, simply because there were enough E-folds after the tunneling, but before the part that we're seeing to get rid of the curvature. All right, so let me just take a step back, though. What would happen if we measured curvature? What would be the implications of measuring spatial curvature? It would have very important implications. At least it would change our picture dramatically of what the universe looks like on large scales. If we measure the curvature and it's positive, that falsifies all forms of eternal inflation in our past. And I'll explain why on the next slide. If we measure the curvature and it's negative, that's a prediction of this landscape model, which is confirmed. And it falsifies the idea that there was slow roll eternal inflation in our past. Why is that? One way to think about it is that there are five quadrupole components. And so, for instance, if you look at the CMB temperature, there are five quadrupole components to that. And if you live in a model that underwent eternal inflation in the past, there is no average curvature. The average curvature is zero. And so the curvature you measure in any Hubble volume is a Gaussian random field, just like the quadrupole components. And in fact, apart from an order one coefficient, it has the same variance as the quadrupole components. So we've drawn five times from that Gaussian because we've measured the five quadrupoles, and we've gotten 10 to the minus 5 each time. What are the odds that we're going to draw a sixth time and get a value that's much larger than that? So the answer is pretty small. Here's the cumulative probability distribution with some, there's some mild dependence on a measure here, but it's very mild. Essentially what this shows, I'm not sure why I extended this plot so far to the left, but it shows that a measurement of omega k at the 10 to the minus 4 level or greater is extremely improbable if you live in a universe that underwent slow roll eternal inflation in its past. In other words, if we measure omega k somewhere in this range, which is allowed currently by observation, we would have falsified eternal inflation in our past, unless the result is negative, in which case we would falsify slow roll eternal inflation and confirm a prediction of this tunneling scenario. It has something to do with the quadrupole, yeah. It's the quadratic correction to the Newtonian potential, if you want. It's the R squared piece, so it's the isotropic piece. So dI, dj of phi, where phi is the Newtonian potential, is a matrix. The off-diagonal elements of that matrix, the traceless part, those are the quadrupole components to leading order. The trace of that matrix is the curvature. So that's why they have a closely related variance. So even if you forget this story about the landscape, even if you ignore what I said about the possibility of having metastable phases, all of this, it does seem that there are some anomalies at large angular scales. So something funny is going on at the largest scales in the CMB data. Now, what that could be, there are many possibilities that have been mentioned. It could be that we're seeing near the beginning of inflation. That's what I've been saying. But it could also just be some feature in the inflaton potential. It could be something else more exotic. But in any case, if we want to go after that, if we want to understand what it is, we should measure as many things as we can on the largest possible scales. And the largest scale observables that we have access to are the low L multiple moments of the CMB. Those have already been measured. And the spatial curvature. The CMB has been measured to cosmic variance limits at low L. The curvature has not. The curvature constraint currently is something like 0.01 or maybe a little bit tighter than that, depending on which data sets you look at. The cosmic variance limit is close to 1 in 100,000. And so there's a lot of room in there for discovering something. And there are, in fact, many different methods we could use to try to improve the constraint or discover curvature. One of them that David Spergel just mentioned to me last week is using kinetics in Yaev-Zeldovich. He claims that with a large galaxy survey, we could get omega k down to a few times 10 to the minus 5. So I don't know whether that's reliable or not. But in any case, it's possible that we can constrain omega k to cosmic variance or close. So just to summarize what I've said about curvature, first of all, if we detect it, the implications are very profound. I think it's not that unlikely that we would detect it. We have some reason to think that it's around the corner. Even apart from that, it's the one thing that remains at very large scales that has not been constrained as well as it could be. And so for these reasons, I think measuring curvature, or at least constraining it, should be a primary goal of cosmology over the next few years. So that's something we should try very hard to do. Okay. So let me shift gears a little bit from curvature. Coming back to BICEP, in many ways, BICEP tells us that it tells us that the scale of inflation was very high. The fact that there are these anomalies at low L may tell us that inflation was short. And that is really the best possible case. That's like, what did you call it, Eva, the Christmas tree model, where there are many things that we could potentially see. So if we're seeing back near the beginning of inflation and we're looking at very high energy scales, this is the best possible case for probing very high energy physics. So one example of that I won't spend any time on besides this, but one example of that is if you're interested in bubble collisions, if you're interested in the possibility that other bubbles that form from our parent Wells vacuum collided with ours and left imprints, the most important factor in how likely we are to see those collisions is the number of E-folds. If inflation was long, it makes our universe very big, and it makes it unlikely that we're going to see any collisions. So you don't want too many more E-folds than are necessary to solve the flatness problem. There's a factor of the square root of omega k in the number of observable collisions, and that goes exponentially with n. So short inflation is good news there. So what should we do while we're waiting for curvature to be discovered? What should we do as theorists? BICEP raises a number of very interesting challenges. One of them is, how do we get inflation to persist over superplankian ranges? There are ways to do that. One of them is axiom monodromy inflation. Another is an effective theory with a shift symmetry, which is related, obviously. Another is something we called unwinding inflation, a model that we've studied recently. So that's one big challenge for model building. How do we get superplankian field ranges? And another challenge, I think, is within this landscape picture, how is it that after tunneling, there's inflation? Why does inflation happen after you tunnel from a high-energy false vacuum? Why don't you just fall down into a minimum immediately? And so there's one model that I'll briefly mention, this unwinding inflation, which has both of these features in the sense that it occurs naturally after tunneling, and it also allows superplankian field ranges. How much time do I have? Oh, okay. So how does this work? Well, the basic idea is it requires at least one compact extra dimension. So this is something you have for free in string theory, but you need at least one compact extra dimension. And you need some metastable phase, which is eternally inflating, in which the energy density in that phase is coming from flux. It's coming from an analog of electric and magnetic fields, but with more indices, higher form flux. In a model like that, there are objects charged under this flux, which in string theory are D-brains. And there's a process which is the analog to Schwinger pair production in an electric field, where a bubble of charged brain appears spontaneously as a quantum fluctuation and then expands. It expands because the flux pushes on it, and it acts to discharge the field. It's just like if you have two capacitor plates and you wait a very long time, electron-positron pairs will appear and short out the capacitor. So a similar thing here, you have a flux, you have a charged object, eventually charge-anti-charge pairs or closed bubbles, which is the brain analog, will appear and act to reduce that flux. The key role that's played by the compact extra dimension is that as these bubbles appear and expand, they wrap around and collide with each other, they collide with themselves on the other side. And if this process continues so that they wrap around many times, you don't just discharge a little bit of the flux, you eventually discharge all of it. So it's a little bit like old inflation, like Alan Guth's original model of inflation, where you were supposed to be inflating in a metastable phase, and then tunneling ended inflation. It's like that, except that the end of inflation happens gradually. You gradually discharge the energy in the false vacuum, and this happens in a way which is homogeneous everywhere in our universe. So that's the new ingredient. One of the reasons why old inflation didn't work is that reheating, the end of inflation, was not sufficiently homogeneous. So here's a little video that shows this happening. So the initial state is constant flux. The height, vertical height here is the amount of flux and the amount of vacuum energy. So the initial state is constant flux. A bubble appears, it expands. This direction is one of the three dimensions of space, and this direction is the compact direction, and the flux discharges unit by unit. The reason this allows you to have super Planckian field ranges is the same reason as there is in axion monotomy inflation. There's a shift symmetry, an approximate shift symmetry, which here has to do with the fact that the radius of this bubble is approximately shift invariant. And so you can get large tensors, where by large I mean 0.05 or maybe 0.1. 0.2 is quite difficult, at least in the versions of this model that we've studied so far. The versions of the model that we've studied so far look like m squared phi squared with a small correction to this power, but it's small typically. But with a speed of sound, so there's a non-minimal kinetic term, and there's a speed of sound which has to be somewhat less than 1. And the speed of sound suppresses r. So m squared phi squared has an r something like 0.14. This model has an r that's less than that. But there are other versions of it that at least naively give you higher powers of phi. They can look like phi to the fourth or even higher powers. So perhaps those versions can accommodate larger r. And the other possibility is, as these people pointed out, it's possible to generate tensor perturbations not just from fluctuations of the graviton in de Sitter, but from some other mechanism, like production of tensors during inflation. Decay of some particle into tensors can do it. Let me just mention one other thing that is currently in progress with Guido D'Amico. So in some sense, Planck constrained non-Gaussianity quite well. Now we know that r seems, at least we think, that r is very high, close to 0.2. That sounds like it more or less rules out non-Gaussianity. That's not quite true. It depends a little bit on your point of view. But if you take this effective theory of inflation point of view, there are really two parameters that you can add at the cubic level. One of them is the speed of sound. The other one is some other parameter. And speed of sound being not much less than 1 still allows you some room to play with this other parameter and remain in the regime where this makes sense, where you're talking, you're not fine-tuning parameters too much. You're in the regime where effective field theory makes sense. And if you plug this in, and this is in progress, so this is preliminary, but it looks like this plot shows FNL orthogonal versus FNL equilateral. These are 1 and 2 sigma constraints from Planck. And this very thin ellipse is what's left if you impose that CS is greater than 0.1. So, okay, thank you. So, of course, this is consistent with 0, m squared phi squared sits there. But this effective field theory of inflation allows a significant and detectable level of non-Gaussianity just as long as it falls within this ellipse. So that's a very strong test because that's a very narrow band. If you measure something that falls outside of that, then it means that inflation is not described by a single field effective field theory. So that's a strong test, and I think it means non-Gaussianity is still very much worth going after and measuring, in case anyone was doubting that. All right, so let me just conclude. Here's a to-do list. The first thing we need to do is detect curvature. If we can't do that, at least let's constrain it as well as we possibly can. It's important that we look for more mechanisms that can allow super Planckian field excursions. Even if r is 0.05 or 0.1 and not 0.2, this is still a very important and burning issue. How do we do that? How do we accommodate that? I think it's very important that we look for mechanisms where tunneling from a high vacuum naturally leads to inflation. That's something that we really don't understand very well. We have only, as far as I know, one example where it happens. But surely there are more ways in which that can happen. We can understand that better. Constraining non-Gaussianity is still very interesting. Detecting bubble collisions, obviously, that would be very exciting. And finally, this is for Matthias. Matthias is going to tell us that all of this is nonsense. Obviously, inflation is m squared phi squared. Why are we even talking about any other possibility? And indeed, this is the simplest model that fits the data, apart from the anomalies at low L. So it's a big target, and we should try to falsify it. Fortunately, it's pretty easy to falsify if it's wrong, because it contains, I would say, two parameters, m and phi at the quadrupole, let's say. And we have already three data points, basically. We have r, we have the tilts, we have delta rho over rho, and more are coming. So let's try to falsify m squared phi squared and make Matthias unhappy. And so that's the last item on the to-do list. So I'll end there.
Questions?
That's a very naive question, Matt. But is it possible that the low L less power is just from initial pre-inflation universe being anisotropic at those scales, and only now those scales are entering our horizon and we are seeing those anisotropies? Or is it already not consistent with that idea?
Well, if you're tunneling high-scale parent vacuum, that thing has been inflating for a long time. So the initial state before the bubble forms is perfectly isotropic and homogeneous.
When the but in slow roll, not in tunneling models.
Oh, just in general.
Slow roll, but initially you had some anisotropies.
Sure. If we're looking at the beginning of inflation and you don't have a theory for what came before, then of course you can simply propose that something was there that had some fluctuations in it, but they were relatively small. Is that what you have in mind? Yeah, I mean, I think if you're looking at the beginning of inflation, this gives us an indication of what might be there. But if this isn't right, or just in generally, right, almost anything could be there, and it's very interesting to study it. So I'd say from that general point of view, we should just do our best to see what's there, what's going on. Is it a broken power law? Is it really anisotropic, the way the power asymmetry makes it look? So what's really going on at large scales? And hopefully that'll teach us something about the pre-inflationary state.
Yeah, I guess just as a general remark. So if your anthropic argument is that there should be no more than enough e-folds to solve the flatness problem, then I guess prior to that you might expect, you know, one possibility is that if you look further back, that like you say, the potential steepens, mm-hmm. but you remain in the inflating regime. But the other possibility is that it's just that right around the 60 e-fold mark, you transition from being kinetic dominated to mm-hmm. potential dominated, in which case you would, you know, past that point, you would suppress not only scalars but tensors. I mean, just because those longer wavelengths that were so long they never had a chance to exit the horizon, neither the scalars nor the tensors will have a chance to get amplified, I guess. Right.
Right. I think that depends a little bit. So if you tunneled again from a high energy vacuum and then you're in fast roll, you still have tensors at large.
Left
scales.
Over from the previous. From
right.
The previous. If you tunneled from a higher vacuum.
Yeah.
That's
if instead
right.
you're just rolling fast and I don't know, in the past there were no fluctuations or something like this, then yes, you can suppress tensors that way. So, okay, if we measure the tilt of the tensors and you know, it's not consistent with scale invariance, one possibility is something like that. Yeah. So whether it can extend out. Right. That's right. So you still, if you're tunneling from some false vacuum, you have large tensors from that. Then you're in fast roll. You can suppress scalars a lot because of that. Like you can be in fast roll for the first however many e-folds and have large tensors. Maybe you can live that way. But I think there are issues. For one thing, you'd be curvature dominated. It's hard to see how you can make that work. But
I think it actually depends a lot on the evolution of the comoving horizon during that time. Right, because if that's something that's growing, then like you said, everything just decay away. Yeah. So it really, I think, depends on exactly how fast the fast roll was and exactly
yes.
how long it lasted.
And if your curvature dominant, right, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so I think we should probably thank Matt again and move on to the next topic.